Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project from the New York Times Magazine. The project makes a case that you don't often hear in history textbooks, that slavery was foundational to America. So it wasn't surprising that we ignited a fierce debate among historians about these issues. But that's the power of the New York Times, to spark an important dialogue with bold, rigorous reporting that forces us to examine our assumptions. To learn more, go to nytimes.com/worth it.
This is a Global News podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jeanette Jalil, and in the early hours of Friday, the 21st of February, these are our main stories. President Trump's former advisor, Roger Stone, has been sentenced to 40 months in prison for lying to Congress. The German president calls for national unity following an attack by a far-right extremist that's left 9 people dead. And the US and Britain blame Russia for a huge cyber attack on the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. Also in this podcast, Turkish troops again clash with Syrian government forces a day after President Erdogan threatened to launch a major incursion. And
the more gin you drink, the better it is for the planet.
Scientists say they've managed to produce the world's first climate-positive gin from garden peas. Roger Stone, one of Donald Trump's oldest friends, has been sentenced to 40 months in jail for lying to Congress. But despite this, the US president continues to insist the political insider is innocent. Stone was also found guilty of obstructing an investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election and tampering with a witness. Stone's lawyers say they intend to appeal. There's speculation that Mr. Trump could issue a presidential pardon. For now, he says, he believes his friend has a good chance of being cleared.
What happened to him is unbelievable. They say he lied, but other people lied too. But I'm not going to do anything in terms of the great powers bestowed upon a president of the United States. I want the process to play out because I'd love to see Roger exonerated, and I'd love to see it happen because I personally think he was treated very unfairly.
Stone, who has worked with Republican presidents dating back to Richard Nixon in the 1970s, has called himself a dirty trickster. Amy Berman Jackson, the judge sentencing Stone, said that his lies were a threat to American democracy. So, was the sentence a surprise? Emily Bazelon is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine.
40 months in prison is a significant sentence. That's 3.5 years almost. And I think the question here, writ large, it should be, I think, about deterrence. If you're thinking about hiding information that Congress needs for an investigation, does someone else getting a 3.5 year prison sentence seem to you like a reason not to do that? I think people have different ideas about how long prison sentences should be. What seems to me to be significant is that Stone is going to prison.
But the prosecution, as I understand it, had asked for a longer sentence.
Yes, they had originally asked for a 7 to 9 year sentence. And then, of course, there was a big hoopla over their seeming withdrawal of that recommendation, though this morning it seemed like maybe they didn't actually withdraw the recommendation. In any case, a lot of questions about whether President Trump's support for Roger Stone spooked the Justice Department out of asking for a longer punishment. And I think there are two questions here. One is the appropriateness of the president appearing to interfere in the Justice Department's process for deciding on a sentencing recommendation, right? Like a process question that goes to the independence of the Justice Department. The second question is how long Stone should really go to prison for. And I think you can be concerned about the process and not necessarily think that he had to go to prison for a really long time.
But the judge was quite clear in her summing up that Roger Stone's lies, in her words, represented a threat to democracy.
Yeah, that's a serious set of conclusions from a judge who was paying very close attention and doing her best to manage this trial in the face, we should say, of a lot of public criticism, including from President Trump. And I think these are serious legal violations, and this is a serious conviction. To me, those questions are separate from the idea that Stone needed to go to prison for many years in order for justice to be served. But I think that is just like a personal assessment that people make individually about how long they think people should go to jail for.
But is it likely that Mr. Stone will spend any time in prison, given it would appear President Trump's inclination to pardon him?
I mean, that is the million-dollar question. Trump has made it very clear that he considers this whole trial to be unfair, even though it's his Justice Department that has carried it out. He is not supporting their efforts in the slightest. And, you know, I think there is this big question about whether he could be concerned about what Roger Stone might say if he got angry about going to prison. And Roger Stone is a friend of Trump's, and Trump does have this pardon power, which we saw him exercise in an extraordinary, very discretionary way this week in other cases. So, you know, in the end, like, he does have the power of the pardon pen.
Emily Bazelon talking to Julian Marshall. The German president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, has appealed to the country to stand united against hatred, racism and violence as he attended a vigil for the victims of the deadly far-right attack in Hanau. His condemnations were echoed by politicians across the political spectrum. 9 people, all of them of immigrant background, were killed late on Wednesday by a gunman who had produced a deeply racist manifesto. He was later found dead alongside the body of his mother. Özcan Mutlu is a former Green Party politician and co-chair of the German-Turkish parliamentary group. He had this reaction to the killings.
I don't want to feel unsafe in my country. Germany is our home. And if people believe that they can kill us and kick us out of this country, which belongs to all of us, this is very, very dangerous.
The bloodshed has plunged Germany into mourning. Vigils and rallies are being held across the country to remember the victims. But along with the tears, there's anger and some fear. Here are the thoughts of 2 people attending a vigil at the Brandenburg Gate in the heart of Berlin.
We are all Turks by birth, but we feel at home in this country. Germany is our country. There is a German saying that goes, when I think of Germany in the night, then I can go to sleep. That's true, especially for us.
That's very, very terrible. I've lived in Germany for 20 years, and I've always felt at home. Yesterday, or today in the morning, I felt like a source of tension.
The authorities say they're trying to establish whether the attacker had links to any racist groups in Germany or abroad. Our security correspondent, Frank Gardner, reports on the challenges that Germany is facing.
Nazi salutes, banned swastika emblems, and even the playing of the Horst Wessel, the one-time Nazi anthem, all have been cropping up in far-right extremist circles as Germany struggles to contain a growing wave of homegrown extremism. The problem has been particularly acute in, but not confined to, the former communist East Germany. Unemployment there is higher than in the rest of the country, and the arrival in 2015 of an estimated 1.5 million refugees from the Middle East has been used by far-right extremists to stoke ethnic tensions. There have been arson attacks on hostels, and this month German police intercepted a suspected plot to target mosques in what was believed to be a bid to trigger a communal conflict. But monitoring far-right extremism is proving to be, in some ways, harder than monitoring jihadists inspired by Islamic State or Al-Qaeda. Unlike the latter, there is no unifying ideology or goal, such as the creation of a caliphate. Instead, far-right extremists tend to share only a hatred of foreigners or other religions, while many espouse their own individual rambling conspiracy theories.
Frank Gardner. His wife has already been charged with murder. Now the Prime Minister of the Southern African state of Lesotho is also expected to be charged in the coming hours with the murder of his estranged former wife. Dipulelo Tabane was shot dead 3 years ago, just days before her husband, Thomas Tabane, became Prime Minister. Our correspondent, Pumza Filani, is following developments from Johannesburg.
In 2017, Dipulelo Thabane, who was at the time the Prime Minister Thomas Thabane's estranged wife, was killed outside her home. And at the time, the police blamed an unnamed gunman. The Prime Minister even commented on the killing, describing it as senseless. So a lot of people for the past few years have generally believed that this was a random incident, until recently, when the police said that they are in fact investigating the Prime Minister's current wife, Maesaia Thabane, who has subsequently been charged with murder and a charge of attempted murder. They also said that they considered the Prime Minister a person of interest. Now, fast forward to what we expect to happen Friday is for the Prime Minister to be presented to the Magistrates Court in the capital, Maseru, where he will be formally charged with murder and a separate charge of attempted murder. This is in connection with a lady who was with the Prime Minister's estranged wife at the time, who managed to survive the shooting. She is a key element in this investigation, and she will be testifying against both the Thabanes.
And what are people making of this in Lesotho, but across southern Africa?
It's been an absolutely incredible story. I mean, it's not every day that you hear of a sitting leader being charged of a crime. There was a time where people thought the investigation would be swept under the carpet, especially in the last few weeks when it started emerging that the police were pursuing the Thabanes. There was a sense that they would try to find a political solution. So people are generally pleased that this maybe shows that the police system in the country is independent, but also that the judiciary is independent, because the First Lady has already been charged and she is currently appearing before the courts.
And where does this leave the governance of Lesotho?
This creates a constitutional crisis, because he is currently a sitting prime minister. The party are in the process of trying to find somebody to succeed him. They'd expected him to tender his resignation this week. They were trying to muscle him out in anticipation of an opening of parliament on Friday. It seems that the prime minister, though, is still holding fort. He does not want to go. But what this then does is it creates a crisis around who the leader will be. It is going to be not only humiliating for the prime minister to be attending a murder case while being a sitting prime minister, but also for the party that elected him. They want to distance themselves from him. They believe he is a sinking ship, and they don't want him to cost them the current power that they enjoy in Lesotho.
Phumza Philani. Who will make up the financial shortfall now that Britain has left the European Union? That's a question EU leaders have been asking at a special summit in Brussels. There are splits between richer and poorer countries on who should pay to fill the gaping hole in EU funding caused by Brexit. Bethany Bell in Austria and Nick Thorpe in Hungary report on the contrasting points of view.
At the Café Diglas in central Vienna, well-heeled Austrians drink coffee at tables with marble tops. They live in one of the richer countries in the EU. Austria pays in more to the EU budget than it receives back. It's a net contributor, along with states like the Netherlands, Sweden and Denmark. Known as the Frugal Group, these countries don't want to pay more into the EU's budget. Sebastian Kurz, Austria's Chancellor, says contributions shouldn't go over 1% of gross national income.
The difference for Austria between 1% and 1.3% per year is 1.5 billion euros. So I'm fighting for every percentage point. And there's a new Commission proposal for 1.114%, and we're against that. We, the net payers, would veto that.
But many of the EU's poorer states, including countries in the Baltics, southern and eastern Europe, don't want to see their aid and development money cut. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orbán objects to the Commission's proposals.
The basic concept of the budget is not fair. We have to say it is in fact unfair. Such modifications have been proposed in the budget, under which money is regrouped to the richer countries rather than to the poorer countries.
Hungary, along with other poorer countries, has benefited hugely from EU funding. The BBC's Nick Thorpe in Budapest says European money has flowed down the Danube.
The Hungarians and other East Europeans want to hang on to every euro they can. Standing here on the Danube shore in Budapest, I'm looking across to Csepel Island and the central wastewater treatment plant. It cost 250 million euros, mostly EU taxpayers' money. EU cohesion funds and money sent home by Hungarians working in the UK, Austria and Germany don't just boost economic growth, they have a political bonanza as well, as economist Zoltán Pogácsa explains.
If these funds were not arriving into Hungary, the growth rate would drastically decrease, the popularity of the government would decrease, and who knows whether they could stay in power. So there is a case to be made that, to a large degree, it's EU transfers that are keeping Viktor Orbán in power in Hungary.
The Austrian political analyst Eva Novotny says the budget talks are harder than usual, not just because of the hole left by Brexit, but also because the EU has a range of new spending plans.
It has never happened before that a country has left the European Union, and that, of course, has budgetary implications. At the same time, I would say that the EU has given itself quite a comprehensive agenda with many new tasks concerning security issues, concerning the economy, concerning climate change, so that needs more resources.
Wer soll das bezahlen? Who should pay for this? Go the words of an old German drinking song. While the frugal group and the poorer states may squabble over money, the big question is what the EU's economic heavyweights, Germany and France, will decide to do. For now, they're keeping their cards close to their chests.
Those reports from Bethany Bell in Vienna and Nick Thorpe in Budapest. You may not have heard of Larry Tesler, who's died at the age of 74, but if you work in an office, you've almost certainly not only used, but heavily relied on one of his inventions. He's the creator of the cut, copy and paste command many of us use every day. Our technology correspondent, Rory Kethlen-Jones, looks back at his career.
It's something computer and smartphone users do every day, highlight some text and either cut it or paste it elsewhere. But it is thanks to Larry Tesler that we can do this. He had come to Silicon Valley in the 1960s, studied at Stanford University and worked as a software engineer at Xerox, and then was poached by Steve Jobs to work at Apple. It was there that he invented both cut, copy and paste and the find and replace feature for Apple's Lisa computer and then the first Macintosh. Until then, computers had been clunky, complex and forbidding machines to most people. Larry Tesler shared with Apple's founder a passion to make them simpler to use. When I met him in 2012, here's how he described Steve Jobs.
Able to not only convince you to rally around a great idea, but convince you to rally around a completely unproven idea that he decided was great and convince everybody else was great. And he was usually, not always, right.
After leaving Apple, Larry Tesler worked at both Amazon and Yahoo, where again he focused on improving human interaction with technology. Another of his former employers, Xerox, paid tribute to him, tweeting, "Your workday is easier thanks to his revolutionary ideas."
Rory Kethlen-Jones on the life of Larry Tesler, who's revolutionised computing and made many people's workdays much easier. Still to come in this podcast.
You're not wearing these bracelets or carrying it around you. When you're at home, you're really doing it outside or potentially at places where you don't know where these devices might be.
We hear about a special bracelet designed to switch off any prying Alexa speaker. The head of the World Health Organization has said he's encouraged that the number of COVID-19 coronavirus cases outside China remains low, but warns it might not stay that way. Speaking after clusters of infection were reported in South Korea and the first deaths in the Middle East in Iran, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus warned the world could not afford to become complacent.
It doesn't mean that this small number of cases in the rest of the world will stay the same for long. It's only a window of opportunity. And that's why we say this is the time to attack the virus while it is actually manageable, small number of cases in the rest of the world.
So far, more than 1,000 people have been infected in 26 countries outside China, and 7 have died. As Tulip Mazumdar reports, the virus is causing concern in nations which up until now have not been affected, such as Ukraine. In Ukraine, protesters have blocked roads to try to prevent people who've been evacuated from China being quarantined close to their homes. The country's president urged people to show some humanity. The Kharkiv regional governor, Oleksiy Kucha, said there was no reason to fear the arrival of evacuees.
First of all those people, 73 of them who'll come back to Ukraine, are healthy. They underwent checks by the Chinese doctors. Afterwards, our doctors who went there also examined them. If the coronavirus is not confirmed, we will bring them back. That's why I ask people not to panic.
The vast majority of cases are still in China, where the outbreak appears to have been slowing in recent weeks. The WHO reiterated that there was a window of opportunity to attack the virus while it is still manageable, but it warned that window might not remain open for long. Tulip Mazumdar. Britain and the United States have joined Georgia in blaming and condemning Russia for a large-scale cyber attack last October that knocked thousands of Georgian websites offline and disrupted national television broadcasts. At a news conference, a Georgian foreign ministry spokesperson, Vladimir Konstantinidi, said Russian military intelligence known as the GRU had been behind the attempt to undermine Georgia.
The investigation conducted by the Georgian authorities, together with information gathered through cooperation with partners, concluded that this cyber attack was planned and carried out by the main division of the General Staff of the Armed Forces of the Russian Federation. The cyber attack was targeted at Georgia's national security and was intended to harm Georgian citizens and government structures by disrupting and paralyzing the functions of various organizations, thereby causing anxiety among the general public.
So, how significant is this Western intervention? Our diplomatic correspondent, James Robbins, gave me his assessment.
This was a really relatively big cyber attack, certainly the largest on Georgia, although not certainly the first that Russia has been accused of. But this had a pretty widespread effect. And today, the US Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, said that this was designed to sow confusion and discord, and Britain's foreign secretary said this was a reckless and brazen campaign and totally unacceptable.
So you've got this coordinated announcement from the US, from Britain, from Georgia as well. Why have they decided to come out now and blame Russia?
The feeling apparently in this case is that if Russia isn't called out, and I should make clear that Moscow has denied any involvement, that if Russia isn't called out, then it's emboldened and will go for repetition and actually disruption on a bigger scale. And I think it's also a measure of Western support for Georgia as one of those countries which lent towards the West after the collapse of the Soviet Union and becoming an independent country, nearly 30 years ago. It's supposed to send a positive signal to Georgia. We're not going to allow this to go unnoticed, if you like.
But you mentioned the Russian denial, so this deterrent strategy doesn't really seem to be working.
Well, it's very difficult, isn't it, to tell to what extent deterrence works because you can't prove a negative. If Russia steps back, for instance, from the sort of attacks which it's been blamed for in Ukraine, when we should remind ourselves over 2 or 3 years, they went much, much further and put the lights out in some cases, blacked out parts of Kiev. The idea is that if you shout about this and make a noise, that perhaps someone in Moscow will say, actually, it's not worth the risk of being called out in this way.
And Russia and Georgia had a brief war 12 years ago, and the wounds have not healed.
Oh, they absolutely have not. President Putin obviously has a very long historical memory. I think it's fair to say that his self-image and his image of Russia is partly based on the history of Russia as the great Soviet power, when, of course, Georgia was no more, no less than a Soviet republic, a satellite, and losing territory in the way that the Soviet Empire did in 1990 and 91 really hurt Russian pride and Russian nationalism. So we've seen aggressive behaviour towards Georgia, towards Ukraine, and this is part of that pattern.
James Robbins. Turkey says two of its soldiers in Syria's Idlib province have been killed by a Syrian airstrike. The Turkish Defence Ministry said its forces had retaliated, killing Syrian forces. This comes as President Erdogan of Turkey has warned of an imminent military offensive in Idlib, where Syrian troops, backed by Russian air power, are trying to capture the region, forcing nearly a million civilians already suffering in freezing conditions to flee for their lives. Here's Sebastian Usher.
Turkish troops have ostensibly been manning a series of observation posts in Idlib to help maintain a ceasefire brokered with Russia. But just as that truce has never really been put into practice, so has the Turkish presence in the province increasingly veered towards backing rebel fighters, with a major reinforcement of troops and military hardware. Turkish artillery fire is playing a key role in a new offensive by opposition and jihadist fighters to try to retake the strategic towns of Sarakib and Nayrab that they recently lost to government forces.
Sebastian Usher. Earlier this week, a former Amazon executive admitted that when he wanted a quiet moment of reflection, he turned off his Alexa speaker. It highlights growing concerns that our digital home assistants may be listening to more than we think. So what's the answer? Well, Professor Ben Zhao from the University of Chicago believes the solution lies in a bracelet. He told my colleague Rod Sharp all about it.
This bracelet basically goes on your wrist. It's very simple to use. There's a single little button, you tap it, and it sends out a pair of very low power ultrasonic audio pulses. And what it does is, because it's on the ultrasonic frequency, you don't hear it, your friends don't hear it, but it turns out that it's carefully tuned in such a way that the microphones that are around us in these Alexa and Siri and these other devices, they can't quite keep up with the ultrasonic frequency, so they vibrate, but they vibrate at an audible frequency. In a way, they jam themselves. They produce a little bit of white noise only at their own little local region. And as a result, they just hear white noise. So when you turn it on, you're able to have a real private conversation without worrying about being eavesdropped. I think the real key point is that you're not wearing these bracelets or carrying around you. When you're at home, you're really doing it outside or potentially at places where you don't know where these devices might be, you know, public places, office buildings, and someone else's home. And you can't just reach over and unplug their device because you want a moment of quiet.
What was it that really sent you down this path?
It was interesting. You know, my wife is also my colleague and collaborator and also a professor at University of Chicago. And when these things first came out, I'm always a sucker for new gadgets and I wanted to buy one and take it home. But she was adamantly against it. I was very concerned about her privacy and our privacy in the home. And that sort of led to the conversation of, well, when can you actually be sure a device is not listening to you? And so we came up with this idea that, well, you know, there's no way to guarantee it except if you proactively do something, something that you can control. And that's how this device sort of came about.
Did it take you long?
It took a little bit of time. The general principle of using ultrasonics to generate a audible sound has been known for about a year, but actually building the device and making it work with really low power electronics and then actually packing it into a little 3D printed bracelet that actually fits around your wrist, that took a bit of time. And of course, there was extensive testing to make sure that it did what it does. And turns out when we talk, we move our wrist a little bit, just a tiny bit. And that is actually enough to eliminate what we call dead spots and make sure that every little region in the space around you is covered. And so no matter where that hidden microphone might be, it actually works quite well at jamming it.
University of Chicago Professor Ben Zhao. Scientists in Scotland claim to have developed the world's first climate-positive gin made from garden peas. The researchers say producing a gin from peas rather than grains removes more carbon dioxide than it creates. Our science correspondent Ken MacDonald has been to meet the distillery owner where the gin is produced.
We're at the Dunnage Room of the Arbeekie Highland Estate Distillery in Angus, and with me, John Stirling, the owner-director. You do vodka from potatoes, you do malted barley, and you turn that into whiskey, but peas into gin, how does that work?
Our distiller, Kirsty Black, her PhD was the extraction of alcohol from legumes and peas. And when she came to work here, she carried that research on. It's taken her almost 5 years now, but she's finally cracked it and she has managed to extract alcohol from peas and beans.
And it has a particular selling point.
Yes, the great thing about peas is the carbon footprint of the gin we make is minus 1.54 kg CO2 per bottle. So it's actually what we term climate positive. Not even carbon neutral, but we're actually helping change the world. So the more gin you drink, the better it is for the planet. That should be our strap line, but I'm not quite sure we're allowed to say that.
I don't know, it's a challenge I'm prepared to accept. The whole idea behind the distillery, gin and otherwise, is about getting things from the field into the bottle with as little other intervention as possible.
Yes, our whole ethos when we set up this distillery was to do things the way they used to be done, which was farm-based distilling. So whiskey originally in Scotland was farm-based distilling, so you'd grow your barley on the farm or rye, and then you'd make whiskey from it. And therefore, we wanted to almost go back in time and start growing everything we produce. So when we make vodka, we grow our own potatoes. We also make a vodka from wheat, which we grow. We then make the gin and the botanicals, and we've planted more juniper on this farm than anywhere in Scotland for the past few years. We've got beehives that also go into the gin. So it's all about sustainability and growing everything on the farm. And obviously, peas is another aspect that just encourages that.
So it's low carbon because you don't use synthetic fertilisers to grow the peas. In fact, the peas are good for the soil because they fix nitrogen. But what about the waste product?
The pea, or the humble pea as we now call it, helps the soil, it helps the soil rotation. We now produce alcohol from it, and then at the very end you've got your pea pot ale that then can go round in the chain and can be fed to cattle. In fact, we're also working in research to look at other uses we can do from that.
Do the cattle like the pot ale, and indeed does it get them drunk?
They certainly come away with a smile on their face, and they're certainly it's always finished at the end of the day, so we think it's definitely got a positive impact on them as well.
And as for the gin, it's called Nadar. Does it taste of peas?
No, because we make a neutral spirit, it's actually slightly sweet, but tastes beautifully clear.
The gin market is a very crowded one, and sometimes it seems that everywhere has its own gin, but this one, fresh to the market, is actually something that does have, for now, a unique selling point.
Ken McDonald reporting, and I get the feeling he rather enjoyed that assignment. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.